The National Endowment for the Humanities turns 50 this year, and their new chairman, Bro Adams, has launched a new initiative supporting public scholarship. Bro Adams joins me in the studio to talk about his background and the future of the National Endowment for the Humanities. I hear that your unusual name, Bro, actually was given to you as a nickname by your father.
That's right. My father, like many in his generation, left college early to enlist in the Army to fight in World War II. And he left Williams College with a friend named Bro. My father ended up fighting in Germany. I'm not sure where his friend ended up, but he ended up being killed. I was born in 1947. My father started to call me Bro, and it stuck. Later in life, I had thoughts about changing it. My father had since passed away. I thought about being called something else, but my mother reminded me that it was his name for me, and so I kept it.
How old were you when you lost him?
18.
How much did that unravel your world?
It was very unraveling, and it led to the single most important event of my early life, which was pursuant to a sort of coming unglued in my first year of college and a dismal sort of experience shortly after my father had died. And I joined the Army in a moment of perplexity and the desire to do something different.
Was the draft in place?
The draft was fully in place.
Did you have a number?
No, I wasn't drafted. I enlisted.
But now I realize you did just what your father had done. You left college and joined the Army.
That's right. And there were many other echoes of my father in that time. I ended up being invited to attend the Officers Candidate School at Fort Sill, Oklahoma, where my father had also gone. And I was commissioned a second lieutenant in the artillery, my father had also done. And at the graduation ceremony, my bars were pinned on by my mother and my father's commanding officer in World War II, General Brittingham.
How long was your Vietnam experience?
It was a long 12 months, but 12 months.
Now that you have your own children, isn't it just unbelievable that at that tender age you were fighting in Vietnam or you were part of the military?
I was not only fighting, I was an officer. So I was responsible for other people and their lives. And I was 20 years old. Yeah, it's pretty startling. Very, needless to say, very strong and affecting experiences. Though I have to say that I was lucky to escape without either deep emotional wounds or physical wounds. So I was lucky.
Do you get those wounds now, though? I mean, do you understand them?
I certainly understand them, and I sympathize a great deal with veterans returning from Iraq and Afghanistan who have those wounds. And I think both the physical and the emotional wounds are things we don't think very much about beforehand, and we end up thinking about them a lot after. As a nation, we probably ought to think about it more at the beginning, because those wounds certainly are inevitable.
I read that that experience led you to begin thinking really hard about what it means to be human. And I'm ashamed to say that I'm not sure that I ever reflect on that myself. I should. We all should. But we're not forced to, most of us.
I think that's right. It's certainly an experience that exposes you to a fair amount of inhumanity. I think that causes you to think about all of it in a deeper and more continuous way. I had a lot of help in that. Most especially when I returned and went back to college, I met up with a philosophy professor at my alma mater, Colorado College, who had written a beautiful book on his experiences in World War II called The Warriors. And that book helped me a lot. And he helped me a lot. It helped me not only understand, but I think incorporate my feelings about the experience into a narrative of my life that might not have been positive, but it was workable. It was something that you know, I think I integrated in a certain way into who I was.
Aren't mentors wonderful?
Yes. And books, too. and great thinking about such things.
Tell me all the different places you ended up teaching, governing, all the different institutions and parts of the country, just to give people a feel for what experience you now bring to the chairmanship of the NEH.
I had a rich and varied academic career. I began teaching at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I went from there back to California, taught at Santa Clara University, and then ultimately at Stanford University. I was teaching at Stanford in the Great Works and Western Culture program, and a little bit in the political science department as well. I went from there and changed roles quite dramatically when I was asked by a colleague at Stanford to go with him to Wesleyan University, where I became a vice president of the university. I went from there to the presidency of Bucknell University, and I went there from the presidency to the presidency of Colby College, where I was for 14 years.
Colby's in Maine?
Colby's in Waterville, Maine.
You have ancestors or family members who lived in Maine.
I did and do. The Adams family has a branch. My branch went to Maine in 1760 or so, settled in the Falmouth area. My father was born in Augusta, Maine. My grandfather was born in Portland, Maine.
Are you related to John Adams?
I am, in a somewhat less direct way.
Your Adams grandfather, I read, delightfully did not have coffee each morning, but you saw him drinking?
Clam juice, which was bracing, I'm sure.
Hot clam juice?
Hot clam juice, every morning.
After which he would say what?
I don't recall him saying anything in particular, but he was devoted to this, and he was a real Maine, he was a salty Maine guy. Loved being around him. He lived in an old house in New England in those days when I spent time with him, and had a barn that was attached to the house like many New England houses, and his wife did not permit him to watch television or to drink in the house. So he would repair to the barn, and when I was there with him, we would watch the New York Giants play football in the barn next to a big hot potbelly stove. He got one channel, and he kept a little bottle of bourbon under his chair and would periodically take a nip.
And offer you one?
Actually, yes, he did offer me one from time to time. That's nothing I've ever admitted to publicly, but he did.
How wonderful.
Yeah, it's a great memory.
It's
a great memory I have.
You had those experiences not because you were growing up in Maine, but you went to a prep school.
I did. The Holderness School in Plymouth, New Hampshire. About a two-hour drive from where he lived in Maine. So he would come over and gather me up at Thanksgiving and other brief holidays. And we'd go to Maine and sit in the barn and watch TV.
So where, with all of this rich and varied background you had, from combat zone to the rarefied atmosphere of elite colleges and prep schools, do you come from as president? Do you think a lot of it is sort of summed up in your initiative called the Common Good?
Much of what I've thought and cared about in the humanities is present in that initiative, whose purpose is to join humanities scholars and organizations to what I have been calling grand challenges in public life. The founding legislation of NEH calls for the agency to attend to the circumstances of contemporary life. I really like that phrase. And so I began thinking almost right away about how I could encourage humanities scholars and organizations to take that sort of public-facing approach to their work and to thereby contribute to the common good, to the betterment of the country.
Aren't they all already doing that?
Well, some are. I think in some ways, however, that over the last several decades, I think humanities scholars, particularly on the academic side of things, have been drawn into a much more technical and professional and inward-facing exercise of the humanities. specialization became the coinage of the realm in many ways. Now, that's true in other places too, the natural sciences. There are certainly places where specialization has become necessary. But in the humanities, it caused, I think, a turning away from or a letting alone of these deeply important human issues that we all wrestle with personally and as members of the public world that need the forms of understanding and knowledge that the humanities offer.
Give me examples.
Well, almost every demanding issue that we face as a people is not a problem that can be resolved by the application of technology. There are issues that deal with our values, our ideas, our history, and our culture. Those are the areas in which the humanities work, and those are the areas in which most of our very significant public challenges, and I would offer personal challenges also, emerge. And so we need the forms of understanding and knowledge that the humanities provide to engage those areas of our lives. And encouraging humanities scholars and organizations to do that is one of the principal things I'm interested in doing at any age.
Have you already funded some of these efforts?
We are just beginning to understand the ways in which we might fund them. We just announced a new program in the research division called the Public Scholar Program, which is an encouragement to humanities scholars, both in the academic world and independent scholars, to turn their work in a more public-facing way, that is to say, to speak to broader audiences. I think we're going to get some very interesting proposals.
As the very new chairman of an organization just about to celebrate its 50th year, when was NEH founded?
NEH was founded on September 29th, 1965. To be precise, and that was the day that Lyndon Johnson signed the legislation creating both the National Endowment for the Arts and the National Endowment for the Humanities, a wonderful piece of legislation and of a piece with the other extraordinary legislative moments of that time, the Civil Rights Act, the Voting Rights Act. It was a tumultuous decade in so many ways. But in the midst of all this tumult, this enormously creative period, and NEH is a product of that period. We have $4.8 billion in grants made to individuals and organizations over that period of time, 7,000 grants to individual scholars, to colleges and universities, libraries, museums, historical societies. It's a brilliant and very important story.
Have you begun talking one-on-one with senators and congresspeople?
I have. I've met with most of our appropriators, both on the Senate and House side, and I will finish the rounds soon as the new Congress takes shape.
And you find friends of the humanities on both sides of the aisle?
Yes, I do. One of the most aisle crossing is, of course, this whole question of historical and cultural legacy in the United States. Without the humanities, there is no cultural and historical legacy in the country. And without the focused attention of NEH, there is no consistent application of the humanities to those issues, because only we are charged exclusively with preserving that legacy. No other foundation is, no other individual is. We are, and we do.
I thought the Battlefield Preservation Societies preserved battlefields and libraries preserve what they preserve. What are you doing?
Our giving goes to many of those kinds of organizations, and we support many, many different important historical landmark sites, and we support many different associations and organizations that are involved with those sites. We gave the sort of the stimulating grant to James Madison's wonderful home and complex at Montpelier, and many grants have followed in the wake of that. We were Ken Burns' first funder in his film on the Brooklyn Bridge. Ken is pleased to say, and I've heard him say it, no NEH, no Ken Burns, because we were there at the start, as we are with many of these organizations and projects. My belief is that the common good, the good of this country, can't be approached or understood without the work of the humanities, our history with our culture, our values, and our ideas. All of that is bound up in a very, very tight way with the humanities. And we need to nourish those humanistic ways of thinking and understanding the world in order to have those strong legacies survive.
Well, Bro Adams, good luck to you, and thank you for sharing your insights.